Mom mutters under her breath. I was hoping to get much more of this done today. There is something that I need to do. After seeing Dr. Jacobson win Hannah over so effortlessly, using the "she only likes Ma" excuse to make myself feel better about standing by and doing nothing is no longer an option for me. If I'm being forced to grow up, I might as well start somewhere. I'll watch her, Ma, I offer and stand to brush the dirt from my knees. You go ahead and keep working. It is the first time anyone in the family has offered to help directly with Hannah, and the shock is evident in Ma's face. She looks up at me admiringly, as though I am an angel, as though I am only acting from the pure goodness of my own heart. My revelation makes me feel despicable. Perhaps if I had just grown up after last winter, if I had used it to make myself a stronger woman, I would have laughed in the postboy's face when he asked me where I lived. I would have been a good sister to Hannah from the start. "Are you sure?" Ma asks, clearly doubtful as she gazes over at the wagon again. She's awfully difficult to handle for anyone besides me. "I'm her big sister, Ma," I reason, except in my head I'm saying, "I'm going to have my own baby, Ma. I should be able to take care of her for you once in a while." "Well, thank you, Amanda." She breaks into a smile, a real one, and it only makes me feel worse. The Lord has blessed me with a selfless daughter. I don't bother to correct her, for her smile is too beautiful, and soon I won't be seeing it for a long, long time. I remove Hannah from the wagon, and she instantly knows that I'm not Ma, which causes her to thrash and scream, her warbled pitch even louder and harder than usual. Ma looks up from the line of stones nervously, but I insist that everything is just fine, and bring the baby with me to a spot in the clearing that is shaded by the cabin. I sit cross-legged on the dirt and cut grass and try to press the baby's head to my neck, like Ma does. But Hannah is still struggling against me, thrashing and wailing and throwing her skull from side to side with remarkable force. The side of her head collides with my jaw, and it makes her cry out all the more. "Hush, sweetness," I whisper, even though I know she cannot hear me. This is the longest I have ever held my sister. I force her wriggling body against mine, despite the screams, and begin to take breaths that are loud and long and slow. I hum as I exhale. My chest vibrates with the sound, and I know Hannah can feel it. For a few seconds, nothing happens. After the fourth exhale, the baby stops struggling and falls limp in my arms, all of her weight suddenly pressed against me, and for a moment, I think she has gone to sleep. Ma looks up from her work in amazement. I turn my head to observe Hannah's face and am shocked to see that her ever-still eyes are wide open. I hum again, and the baby's hand begins to move over my face like a curious sea star. She touches my lips, my nose, my eyes, devouring them, learning every curve. She pulls at my hair, then runs her hand gently over it, squeezing the different sections of my braid in between her tiny, curious fingers. As she feels, her little face twists into a variety of expressions, some cute, some atrocious, all of them bright and quick as a flash before fading into the next. "Bark!" Hannah moans along with me as I exhale. I run my fingers through the baby's curls as I continue breathing aloud. Hannah gurgles at the softened touch, and goosebumps flourish over her little arms. I hold her like that, rocking and humming and running my hands over her head, until Ma finishes lining the yard. After a while, I lay the baby on her back in the warm dirt. She starts to panic at first, but I quickly slide my hands down her legs and put her bare feet up against my chest as I continue to hum. Hannah breaks into a smile that warms my blood, and I am suddenly overcome with the urge to sob. For months I've had horrible thoughts about this baby. I've been sure that my life was horrible, I've been unable to imagine a future to be desired, but in Hannah's brief smile, I now see endless possibilities. Possibilities that are already ruined because of what I've gone and done. Possibilities that don't include raising a child completely alone. I watch Hannah for the remainder of the afternoon. The rest of the family looks on in dumb confusion, but Ma seems lighter, happier, as though I have lifted an invisible weight from her shoulders. Already her posture has improved, and her face is much more relaxed. Just before Ma and Emily are about to start on supper, Pa emerges from the cabin and announces that he has finished the floor. "You're sure it's ready to live in?" I ask while Hannah tugs at my hair. Something inside of me feels hesitant to go inside.
"It's ready," Pa says. "I told my family I would provide them with a home, and I've done it. Everybody come see. We'll eat supper and sleep inside tonight."
We all head for the door with slow, hesitant steps, and I suddenly remember the crying infant and the tiny hand wrapped around my wrist in the night. Why am I filled with such dread at the idea of sleeping inside? Camping has been horrible, but it's been so long since we left the mountain that I'm almost used to it by now. With a final sigh that causes Hannah's smile to fade, I walk inside. Pa has lit 5 oil lamps, one for each corner of the large room, with another hanging from a thick wire hook that protrudes from the roof. All of the bloodied bark has been scraped off with Pa's draw knife, and the fresh clay has been slathered in between the logs. The new floor looks wonderful, and as impossible as I would have thought this to be when we first arrived, it smells wonderful too. Woodsy and fresh. Clean. Like a true new start. "Oh, Edmund," Ma gasps softly and rests her hand on her chest. "It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. There is so much space." This is the warmest I've seen her act toward Pa since before we left the mountain. He seems to notice it too, and kisses the top of her head, a proud grin awakening on his face. Ma's happy mood continues while we empty the wagon and arrange our things in the cabin, and she gives Hannah big kisses on the nose after every time another section is organized and complete. The new cabin is able to fit all of the tools from our old woodshed, the draw knife, the grinding stone for sharpening blades, the augers used to drill holes in wood. Besides the scattered array from the shed, this home also allows us to store all of our cooking pots and utensils inside, instead of keeping them tucked in a cluster right outside the front door. The size of the fireplace matches the space around it. Even with the iron frame used to hold pots over the flame placed inside, there is enough room for Charles to walk around in it if he crouches. He and Joanna dart in and out of its mouth, making faces at each other around the sides of the empty stew pot in the center. The rocking chair looks lonely in the middle of the huge room. Both mattresses are arranged in their own corners, each with more than enough space to easily store our individual piles of clothing against the wall, while still leaving plenty of walking room. Pa promises that it won't feel so empty once he's built a shelf, a headboard, and a table with some chairs. "It's ready for the final touch," Ma claps excitedly once everything is in place. She pulls a large brown furry thing from the corner with the woodshed tools, tied tight into a wide roll with cloth strips, and Pa grins from ear to ear at the sight of it. "Old Grizz," he says affectionately to the hairy pile as Ma unties the strips.
"I was wondering when you were going to come out to play."
She rolls out the grizzly bear rug that Pa made for her when they were young, his first bear killed on a hunt, and a permanent member of the Verner family ever since. The massive head clunks over the hollowed floor like a rock, and the claws scrape lightly across the hardwood while Ma adjusts the rug's position. Because of all the fuss, dinner consists of dried meat, dried fruit, and nuts. The children sit in a circle on the floor with Emily while I play a tickling game with Hannah, who is more than happy to notice that I no longer hesitate to touch her or be within reach of her chubby little hands.
"I can't even hold her like you are, Amanda,"
Pa admits from where he sits in the floor, cleaning his rifle.
"It's like you've put her under some sort of spell." There will be no mention of spells or black magic in this home, Ma says as she rocks before the glowing fireplace, her Bible in her lap. This is a home of the Lord, and we will treat it as such.
Oh, you know what I meant. Pa sighs and peers into the barrel of the gun. I'm just impressed is all. Amanda sure has a way with our Hannah.
This is the first time that Pa has spoken to me with tenderness in his voice for nearly a year. It fills me with a joy that I didn't know I wanted, a sort of cozy familiarity that I didn't realize I was missing. It comes naturally to you, certainly, Emily says, her voice flat. She rips a piece of dried meat with her front teeth. You seem to have a gift with babies. I shoot her a look. She raises an eyebrow at me and takes another bite. Perhaps she is still grouchy over the absence of Zeke. He hasn't come once for water like he promised he would, and I can't help but feel a very sick satisfaction over it. If she's going to continue treating me like an acquaintance, I don't want her to have anyone else to be close with, either. Let her see what it's like to be alone. Let her be the one pushed to the realization that she and I need each other. Well, it doesn't surprise me that Hannah has taken so well to Amanda. Ma smiles at me from the rocking chair. You are 16, after all, and by God's grace, becoming more and more of a woman every day. Hannah squeals in glee as I clap her hands together, but my stomach turns. I know what's coming next, and as much as I wish to stop it, I know what Ma is about to say. Some day, sooner than you think, you may find yourself married with your own family to take care of in such a loving manner. I start to rest my hand over my stomach when I jump at the sound of someone knocking on the glass window from the outside. Tap, tap, tap. I look to the window in alarm, only to see nobody. What is it, daughter? Ma asks. Didn't anybody hear that? I say. Someone knocked on the window. Emily tries to hide her excitement, but I see right through the attempt. Perhaps it's the Jacobson boy coming for his water? The Jacobson boy. Does she really think she sounds less giddy than if she had called him Zeke? And if he hasn't come to collect any water until now, I've a feeling that our well pump isn't the only resource they have. Still, it is odd that he came in the night. Pa looks up from his rifle. Really? He says. I think I missed it. He stands and disappears outside. We all sit by in silence, listening to Pa call out hello into the dark prairie, waiting for someone to answer him. The sound of his footprints moves in a slow circle around the cabin, and before long I see the top of his head flick by the window. He comes back in and shuts the door behind him. You imagined it, daughter, Pa says, a touch aggravated at being pulled away from his gun. I knew I didn't hear anything.
I did hear it, I say fiercely, irritated that nobody else heard it, and nervous as to who exactly is out there knocking on windows at night. I did. Nothing to make a fuss over, Ma croons from her chair. Mistakes happen. Our lives are going on just fine.
It wasn't a mistake.
Amanda?
Pa raises his voice as he looks at me from across the cabin. The tenderness he had for me a moment ago is gone. The light of the oil lamp causes his beard to cast a ghostly shadow over the rest of his face.
There wasn't anybody there, or if there was, they sure ran off in a heartbeat.
I imagine Zeke Jacobson tearing through the dark prairie, with only the light of the moon to guide him back to the forest. What would he do once he reached the trees? The moon wouldn't help guide him through those. When everybody has finished eating, Ma strokes Emily's freshly brushed hair while she reads through the book of Ephesians in a silky voice. She reads over the verse she quoted to me earlier today, the one about forgiveness, and slows her tone to emphasize the words as she speaks them. If Emily absorbs the message, she doesn't show any signs. She's probably mad at me for making her think that Zeke was here. She probably thinks that I did it on purpose to torture her, that I'm so miserable I can't stand the idea of her being happy, that just because I ruined my own life, I'm somehow expecting her to take away some of the pain, whether it is her responsibility to or not. That is the kind of person my sister thinks I am. I'm going to fall asleep early, I say, and change into my nightshirt after Pa goes outside to smoke tobacco from his pipe. I'm exhausted.
I'm sorry, dear,
Ma stops reading and places her fingers on the page so she can look up. Was the baby too much for you today?
Oh, no, I insist. I enjoyed it, really. It was just a big day is all, with moving everything into the cabin.
Ma thanks me for what seems like the 100th time and begins reading again. I pause before crawling beneath the thick quilt on our old mattress, savoring the fact that at least I will no longer be sleeping on the ground. It was bad for the baby. I'm sure of it. The bed is more wonderful than I remember, and I exhale deeply as I close my eyes and turn to face the wall. My body sinks into the soft mattress, cradled, and I want to stay in bed forever. Phantom sounds aside, the first night in my new home feels admittedly more comfortable than I ever could have hoped. No more worrying about snakes, no more pretending to ignore the stagnant presence of a blood-soaked cabin. Mistakes happen, like Ma said, and once my big one is brought into the light, our lives will continue to go on, right? Why couldn't they? I will repent for my sins. I will use this to become stronger. I am changed. Maybe tomorrow I can try to talk to Emily, fix things between us. Maybe tomorrow my fresh start can really begin. 12. The pain strikes me with an intensity that almost causes me to scream into the night. It is below my belly, deep inside of me, and feels like a knife cutting through all my muscle and gristle, like they are nothing but butter left out in the sun. I throw my hand over my mouth to conceal the gasp, stand and stumble to the door, slipping out carefully as not to make a sound. The dark sky of the prairie is streaked with early morning dim blues and yellows, something that would usually take my breath away with its beauty, but I hardly notice it now as I try to get as far away from the cabin as possible, so I can howl into the back of my sleeve without waking anyone. I run for what feels like miles through pebbles and grass and flowered weeds before I collapse in another wave of pain. I feel a terrible rush of wetness and grab beneath my nightshirt, in between my legs. My hand comes back covered in blood, thick and rich and disgustingly fragrant in the cool morning air. Even as the tears pour down my hot face and I stifle another scream with my clean hand, I know what has happened. You got what you prayed for. I sob into my skirt, holding my shaking and bloodied hand as far away from me as I can. No, no, no. With each wave of searing pain, I see Henry's face, how it studied mine with such curiosity the first time we met, when I came to the mountain town with my paw. How it twisted in pleasure while he rode me in the woods behind our cabin with animalistic urgency. How it gazed upon me in disgust when I told him I carried his child. The agony continues longer than I could have ever imagined. I hear someone behind me before I see them. In my delirium of pain, I assume it's Ma or Pa, come to find me out and bash my head in as punishment. When it's Emily who sinks beside me and pulls my head into her chest, all I can think is, at least there's that. Then I hear my own screams and mistake them for my babies, and pray that I die anyway. I sit with my sister, wailing into her lap, while she rocks me back and forth, and my baby gushes from my body and soaks into the earth. 13. When the bleeding finally stops, the sun is dangerously close to peeking up and over the horizon of the flatlands. My sister knows that we have very little time. We need to move, she whispers into my hair after my cries have died away. I'm so sorry, Amanda, but we need to move now. So I frantically rub my hand, still coated in the terrible crimson, against a slew of dried grasses before wiping away the excess muck on a clean spot of my nightshirt. After hiding the blood-soaked shirt underneath a divot in the earth that is covered by dense growths of waist-length grass, Emily asks me if I'm all right. I do not know, I say in a shaking voice as I stand naked before her.
The insides of my thighs are still smeared with the heavy blood. My baby is dead, Emily.
Yes, she says and puts her hand on my shoulder. I wish she'd say more on the matter.
I need to get you some clean clothes while you wash yourself at the pump, before they wake up.
My shock makes the world feel unfamiliar and new. I wish she'd tell me if this was a good thing or a bad thing, if God did this on purpose, if he suddenly realized, oh, hi, well, isn't this a big mess for poor Amanda Verner, or if it was even God that did it at all. I want her to tell me if this terror was carefully thought out and written into my plan, or if I'm some sort of error of the Lord's nature that has broken through the barrier and spiraled straight into Satan's claws.
You prayed for this.
The blood drying on my legs is unclean, excess sin that stinks of a much different future than what I've prepared myself for in the past months. Still, I feel heavier instead of lighter, and sick with lingering cramps as we walk back to the cabin in silence. Emily wraps her arms around my shoulders so I can lean on her as we make our way to the well pump.
Wait here, she whispers when we get close.
She disappears around the corner of the cabin to go inside. Once she's returned, Emily helps me finish splashing water from the pump over myself. It runs red over my calves and feet, then pink, then clear. The water is shockingly cold, but I don't allow myself to flinch.
You deserve much worse than cold water.
Ma and Pa awaken only minutes after I wiggle into the clean underwear, skirt, and blouse that Emily fetched me.
What are you two doing up already?
Ma's voice calls from outside the front end of the cabin.
Is everything all right?
Everything's fine, Ma.
Emily bellows back from where we stand near the pump as she scours me from head to toe for any signs that might have been left over.
Amanda felt slightly overheated this morning. She just needed a moment to splash some water on her face.
Amanda?
Pa barks from inside the cabin, his voice smoky and hoarse in the early hour.
Is that true?
I'm feeling better,
I say with as much enthusiasm as I can manage, but my voice sounds fragile. Dangerously close to breaking. Luckily, neither of them take further notice. When we go back inside, Ma calls for Emily to help her with breakfast and hands Hannah to me so she can fetch some water for the oatmeal. She just plops the baby onto my hip, like it's nothing, and turns away. Hannah smiles and grabs onto my braid. Suddenly, my knees are shaking and feel as though they are about to give out, and I sway with the baby's added weight. I hear Ma outside using the pump, standing in remnants of her own grandchild, and I have to sit down with Hannah on the spot to keep from fainting. My baby sister clings to me, all but asking for me to return the affection, but I just look down at her as the world descends into madness around me. My heart feels cold. I don't tickle her, or kiss her neck, or hum against her body. And I suspect it's the reason her tiny hands act mopey and confused as they rake over the wooden floor to feel around for Joanna and Charles's jacks. She periodically reaches out to grab my leg, to make sure that I'm still here, but I can hardly bring myself to do anything more than give her a weak nudge in assurance. Her dark little eyebrows furrow around her still gray eyes. Emily watches me very closely throughout breakfast and cleanup. When I go to wash the oatmeal pot outside, she puts her hand on mine to stop me.
We can trade days, she offers with a weak smile.
At least it's a smile. And at least it's for me.
You just sit and take in the morning, sister.
It almost sickens me that I had to miscarry my baby for her to offer me smiles and kindness again, but I don't have the mental or physical energy to become bitter over it now. More than ever, I need my best friend. Without another word, Emily and I hug each other tightly.
I'm here for you, sister, she whispers, and I am so sorry.
I knew ever since I was 7 years old that Emily was meant to be the big sister, and I was meant to be the little one, following and pestering and making things difficult when really they were quite simple. God must have mistaken our souls for one another, sent them to the wrong bodies. An understandable mistake, since certain pieces of us might as well be one of the same.
They never have to know,
Emily murmurs, and she uses my shoulder to soak up a tear that has run down her cheek.
I'm certain the Lord would understand.
All right. I haven't cared if the Lord understood me since last winter.
I see you two have finally made up. Ma beams from the doorway. It's about time. Nothing in this world is powerful enough to tear two sisters apart.
Neither Emily nor I bother to correct her.
Everybody seems eager to spend some time out of the sun and inside the cabin, and I find myself grateful beyond words that the room is large enough for everybody to live comfortably and spread out with their own amount of personal space. If I had to endure this torture in the tiny mountain cabin, I would have lost my mind again, without a doubt. The children immerse themselves with their newly unpacked playthings in one corner, while Ma reads from the Bible and Pa gets geared up to go into the forest for some wood. I sit pretending to draw, my back against the hard, rough walls of the logs, and Emily eyes me from where she goes through her button collection nearby.
Thank you for giving me space without making me ask for it, I want to say.
I'm going to take Rocky in the cart so I can load up a bunch at once, Pa says before stepping out into the sun.
His rifle lies across his back, and deerskin gloves peek out from the top of his breeches. He places his hat over his head and looks back at us all, sitting comfortably in the home that he made for us. His face is lit up with pride.
I'll see you all in a few hours.
Once Hannah wakes up, I avoid her altogether and pretend that I need to relieve myself when she reaches away from Ma and starts to wail and search for me. I can hear her cries from where I lean against the back of the empty wagon outside, low-pitched and warbled and ugly, and I feel as though I would do anything to silence her. My fingers curl into my palms until the nails create crescent-shaped slashes stinging with blood, and I clench my teeth until I fear they will crack. I hardly make it to bedtime without screaming. Then, in the night, I hear the sound of the crying infant again, right outside the end of the cabin, around where the well pump is. I'm still groggy from sleep, and something in my head tells me that it's my baby crying for me, that I have to get to it. But once I stand up and awaken a bit more, I realize that isn't possible, that my baby died early this morning, and there shouldn't be any sound outside the cabin at all. Yet the crying carries on, loud enough to wake everybody up, and my family continues to sleep as though it isn't happening. I refuse to accept that the Lord would mock me in such a way. I walk outside and around the corner of the cabin, stubborn and sure, the moonbeams casting a silver glow over the prairie. With each step, I challenge the sound of the crying to carry on. There's no way that I am going to see a baby lying on the bloodied ground beneath the pump when I turn the corner. It simply isn't possible. Yet the sound continues, growing louder as I approach the back of the cabin. I continue holding my breath, even though my chest is beginning to hurt, and step into the back clearing. The crying stops instantly. As if to confirm my victory, I walk up to the well pump and rest my hand on it. There's nothing out here. Like I suspected, there are only the sounds of my mind. But why have I heard the cries twice now, once before I lost my baby, and once after? It's like a follow-up to a warning I never understood. Did my mind know the miscarriage was coming somehow? Somewhere deep down in the subconscious? Was it trying to warn me beforehand? I go to turn back for the cabin, but something catches my eye in the distance, a tiny flash of metallic green light in the shadows. Up ahead, right around the spot where Emily found me collapsed in the dirt, I can see the piercing reflected shine of what looks like a pair of animal eyes peering at me through the darkness. They are so low to the ground that they can't belong to a coyote, but are large and still enough not to be a jackrabbit's. I strain my eyes, willing the moon to help me make out the creature, and slowly but surely a shape comes into view. I freeze, suddenly terrified that I am out here alone, suddenly understanding why I will never come out at night again. The eyes belong to a baby standing upright in the grass, staring at me without emotion or a sound. My spine feels alive, like there are ants crawling over it deep beneath the muscle, and my breath catches in my throat. The baby still hasn't moved by the time I start walking, backward, toward the front of the cabin. Even after the figure fades from my view into the shadows, I don't turn my back in fear that it will get me. Once the front door is in sight, I bolt for it.
I climb back into bed, my blood uneasy and my heart pounding in my ears. And that's when the crying starts up again, just outside the wall near the well pump. Nobody stirs, and this time I am not surprised. They are not the ones being haunted. Haunted. I am being haunted by the ghost of my unborn child. 14. Hannah was blue when she was born. Emily, Joanna, and Charles had all been a grayish-pink color. But when Hannah tore her way into this world, I knew instantly that something was very wrong. There was no weak or startled cry from the still blue baby, just a horrible wet slapping sound as she slipped out, feet first, from Ma's torn womanhood and into Pa's arms. There was no midwife, like there had been for all my other siblings and myself. The snow had been too deep to reach the village on the other side of the mountain for close to 4 months straight, and our tiny home in the sky was transformed into an icy prison. By then, we were all a little strange. When the baby finally came out, Ma's guttural howls were silenced for the first time in hours. Emily covered her mouth and began to cry at the sight of Hannah. I stood in dumb shock, still holding Ma's right leg up in a sort of daze. How long had it been? It felt like years since the labor had started, and I had no inkling if it was early or late. Ma's face and hair were soaked with perspiration. There was a heavy stink in the air.
Please, Lord,
Pa begged under his breath, hitting the slimy blue baby on the back with one hand, while Emily and I watched.
Please, Lord.
Once Ma had gotten the illness 4 months earlier, it wouldn't stop for anything. Not desperate prayers, not a pregnancy, and certainly not a snowstorm that kept us stranded without any help or extra supplies. Nobody else ever caught it. Pa said it was because her body was especially prone when with child.
Amanda,
Pa snapped, accusatory, as if he could sense that I hated Hannah already for what she'd done to my mother.
Help me.
I gently set Ma's trembling leg down on the bed, the sheets and mattress clotted with blood and birth fluid and stinking waste. Joanna and Charles were still sitting in the opposite corner of our family's log cabin, facing the wall and playing a game of jacks with each other, like we'd told them to do when things started looking bad. They never turned as commanded. They had no idea what was behind them. And at 5 and 6, they shouldn't have had to know. I only just got to Pa when Hannah started moving. Her tiny arms and legs flailed around like those of an overturned mountain beetle. She took sharp, violent little breaths for a few moments, and her color warmed a shade. She wasn't crying.
Is my baby all right?
Ma slurred from the soaking bed as Emily wiped her face.
What's happening?
I think she's all right,
Pa said, his voice deep and breaking apart under the stress. And that's how Ma found out the baby was a girl. But I could see Pa's face as he looked down at Hannah, whose eyelids were pulled into half-open slits as she took in those noisy little breaths. Soon the breaths turned into weak, off-key yelps. She pawed at his hands as if fighting them away. Pa sliced the cord away from her navel with his knife, and I wondered if I would vomit before the night was through. Emily whimpered.
"Why isn't she crying?"
Ma demanded again. I went to her side and felt her face, still hot, searingly hot, just as it had been for hours now and for most of this winter. I wondered if Ma would ever be able to remember anything from the past 4 months, if she didn't end up dying first. "She's perfectly fine, Ma," I whispered gently, and Emily looked at me in shock. "Hush," I wanted to say. I motioned for Emily to help me clean up the bed and the area around it. We gathered the excess blankets, heavy with thickened blood, and shoved them through the freezing window, little by little, out into the snow. As I pulled the crudely cut glass panel back in, I could have sworn I heard someone call my name from outside. Pa had warned us that our minds might turn funny from being trapped in here altogether for so long. I needed to ignore it. Without a word, I swiped the large tin cooking pot from the corner of the cabin and made my way to the front door. The door was still mostly jammed shut, but after beating at it for a few minutes, I was able to create an opening just wide enough to scoop some snow into the pot.
After rustling the door shut again, I set the pot over the fire and waited as its contents melted away. There was nobody outside, I thought. I didn't hear a thing. Joanna and Charles had both placed their hands over their ears by now. Hannah's yelps continued, growing louder by the minute. None of my other siblings had sounded like this. Wasn't it supposed to be a small bout of crying followed by calm and quiet? Or was I misremembering? Emily was waiting for me in the pot of hot water at the bedside, with a small pile of clothing and linen scraps in her arms. They were the last clean ones, set aside especially for the birth, weeks beforehand, and we would need to use them well. Nobody asked about Hannah. We were too scared to. Instead, Emily and I silently dunked the fabric pieces into the water and began to clean Ma's body of all the blood and fluids. Pa used one of the scraps to clean Hannah off properly, then wrapped her in the many layers of cotton and wool that Emily and I had gathered when Ma's labor started. I held the gasping baby for a moment while Pa went over to Ma. Hannah's eyes were a stunning but strange gray color, and I wondered even then why they weren't moving to look into mine. Despite her tiny size, her cheeks were soft and puffy, and she had several thick wisps of dark hair that curled around the top and sides of her face. "Hello, baby," I whispered into her ear to try and calm her, but the attempt to soothe only failed. Hannah clawed at my face, grabbed at my hair, made horrible yelling sounds. The amount of strength she had for what she had just gone through astounded me. Even healthy babies were slow and weak at first. The thought occurred to me that perhaps Ma's fever had spawned a demon. Pa pulled a newly cleaned Ma up and propped her against the headboard. Her breaths were long and steady, and he announced that the fever was finally starting to go down, thank the Lord. Pa wriggled her soaking nightshirt up around her shoulders and took Hannah back from me. The baby fed eagerly while Ma talked nonsense in her sleep. While Hannah nourished herself, Pa pulled the nightshirt off around the top of Ma's head and replaced it with a clean one from Emily. Outside, the snow was still never-ending, causing the cabin to take on a dull blue tone, which only made Hannah's color look all the worse. The air was frigid. Emily and I dumped the bloody water out the window and immediately began working on relighting the fire. Pa hummed an old hymn in his deep voice and told Joanna and Charles to come meet their new baby sister. The children approached the bed with slow caution, the fear all too evident in their large brown eyes and flushed skin.
"Is she all right, Pa?"
Charles asked in a weak voice. My brother looked around the bed with wide eyes, at the blood on the floor and the soiled rags piled nearby, before turning to the baby.
"The Lord spared the lives of both Hannah and your Ma," Pa said firmly, "and that is the greatest gift we could ever ask for. Everything is fine."
"But her eyes..."
Joanna broke her silence for the first time in hours. She leaned closer to the baby with a twisted face.
"I think there's something wrong with them."
The back of Pa's hand flew into Joanna's face with such a swift and sudden force that all of us jumped. He had never hit one of us before, had never even come close. The sound of the baby suckling on Ma became deafening, nearly unbearable.
"There is nothing wrong with her," Pa snapped, his voice rising. "This is your kin. Do you understand me? This is your baby sister from God."
Poor little Jo's hand flew to her cheek, where an angry red mark was already beginning to bloom. Her lips failed to hold the barrier, and quick, pitiful sobs began to escape. Pa raised his hand again, as if daring her to continue. Joanna fell silent. "The snow is eating away at us," I thought. "It is turning our hearts into ice."
"Everybody get some sleep while you can," Pa said, breaking the silence, and went to lie down next to Ma and Hannah, who were both still.
They looked like corpses, tinged strange colors, positioned like grotesque dolls over each other on the bed. Pa checked to make sure they were both breathing, and everybody lay down. The baby started crying again within the hour, and she didn't stop for a long, long time. Was it 3 days? 4? 6? However long it was, it felt like years. Years of only opening my eyes when Pa commanded me to move out of the way so that he could get one thing or the other for Ma, or the baby, or when my assistance was needed to turn over the mattress or recover it with a crudely washed sheet. The children cried on and off over the deafening sound of the baby, and Emily rebraided her hair dozens of times a day to keep her fingers busy and her eyes downward. Pa stuffed strips of cloth into his ears. Hannah kept screaming. Ma kept coughing. The walls of the cabin began to move inward, making the space even smaller, taking more air away, suffocating us all slowly. Slowly. For the first time, I prayed that the baby had not survived the delivery.
Why us?
Pa begged the Lord for mercy.
How cruel.
Ma's cough kept on. The walls moved in closer. For the first time, I wondered if God was real. Once the tiny cabin was finally still and quiet, I arose in the dim light of what could have been either early morning or evening and went to stand in front of the window once again. Everybody in the family was sleeping heavily, or perhaps they were dead. I neither knew nor cared as I stepped over their bodies and made my way to the tiny square of glass that mocked me with the promise of outside. All I wanted was to look out into the open space of the earth and remind myself that freedom was still awaiting me, that the world included much more than the inside of this matchbox, that I hadn't died and gone to hell. After wiping the condensation from the freezing window with the sleeve of my dress, I leaned close enough for the glass to touch the tip of my nose. And that is when I saw the devil. It was the strangest thing. But I swear he heard me looking at him from all the way across the forest, through the trees and trees and trees that seemed to go on forever, surrounding me, smothering me, trapping me there on that mountain. I saw him and he knew. He heard. He stopped dead in his prowl and cocked his head toward me with a viciousness that caused me to jump. I squinted through the glass, unable to believe what I was seeing, and wondered if I was dying, and if he had come into this hellish storm just to collect me. While the creature stood peering at me, motionless now, his lips parted to reveal gnarled black fangs, and I could hear his whisper as if he was standing right next to me. Sinner. Then he was coming for me, all black and shining with horns and claws and those gleaming gnarled fangs. He stepped through the falling snowflakes, leaving steaming footsteps of blood that bloomed into the ice. I've come to devour your soul, the whisper inside my ear said, and I began to scream. His voice wavered like notes played on a fiddle. It sounded familiar. It sounded like mine. I fell back from the window, still screaming, throwing my hands in front of me to keep the creature away, while my family cried out in confusion from their beds. I only remember little bits for a while after that. The silence, the crying, the scratches I kept reopening on my face and arms with my fingernails. I don't remember when Ma got better, or when she started reading to me from the Bible every night until the snow melted, or when Emily went anywhere except by my side with her hand in mine. I do remember hearing them argue about me. Ma blamed herself for Hannah and for me as well. Pa was angry that she wasn't more thankful for the baby's life or her own, for that matter. He told her over and over again that it was the isolation that had turned me strange, that as soon as the spring came, everything would straighten out. It was a miracle the entire family survived at all, he bellowed. Amanda will get better soon. When my tongue found itself capable of allowing me to speak once again, I told Emily that I didn't know what I saw out the window that had set me off. I kept it from her until after we were out. After it was spring, and the snow was only slush gathered around the bottom of the tree trunks, and the sounds of animals could be heard once again in the air of the mountain. I told her then, but only because I couldn't lie about it anymore. I couldn't pretend that I hadn't seen him, calling for me, wanting to eat my soul, for every time I heard a snapping branch or scatter of animal feet in the forest, I was certain he had returned for me, his sinner.
Your mind wasn't right,
Emily pleaded with me, finally understanding my ever-wide eyes and jumpy demeanor.
You should have told me, sister. No more lies. You should have let me protect you and tell you that it wasn't real. The winter made you strange. Your mind made a mistake. That's all.
No. There are no mistakes, no matter how cruel. There's only God's plan, sung over and over again like some lovely children's rhyme told on rainy days. Smitten lies and bloody thighs and a prairie home reeking of evil. What is happening on this prairie? Is there evil within it, like the place in Henry's story, torturing me from afar until the time comes to claim its prey? Is my whole family doomed to death after all? Or is it all of it? Just me.